a better product. And consequently, what we're trying to instill in our group is a kind of a similar idea. That is, our shareholders, this is your tribe. Right? And there's a reason for you to go through this process of being educated. It's not going to take you away from the people you love, right? Which is what education has done in the past, starting from, when you were a little fella, they jerk you off to the EIA boarding school, right? And there they kind of mash your mind around like this for a while, and they'd say, well, maybe you're ready for college, so they send you off to Durango somewhere. And they, expect you to compete. Well, what that doesn't do is that it doesn't keep you together with your closest people, does it? It tears you apart. As you come back, you don't have the same language anymore. You're communicating in some foreign language, and your grandparents can't talk to you. They don't pass anything along. And so what we're going to try to do is develop a means by which this continuity is there, right? From the little fellas through the aged. We were talking about this business down here in Southeast where the older people are engaged in the manufacture of certain Tlingit items, carving and basketry maybe. And I think that's a great thing, because it's not so much the product as it is the process, right? Because, as a little child, you remember all these things that are going on. And so if we got some old guy who can make these beautiful old sleds they used to make, out of hardwood, and you have this, and generally you don't teach by saying, well, you do this and you measure it this way, and, it's a means, it's a process of, interaction with this person that is most important. How to communicate, and they'll be explaining all the different parts of their own language and how they go about, measuring and that sort of thing. And also, I will sell that to a museum or some dog musher, or even the kayaks even, developing. Going through the process of building a kayak. You see, one of the problems that we've had, and you've seen it in our course here, where the reasons the Puritans assumed that the Indian was an idiot, or practically, was that he didn't understand. Just because he didn't have a writing system, they assumed that they were inferior. But the fact of the matter is, their learning process was different. It was not something you wrote down, it was something that was ingrained in you. And just like in say Aleut or in the Eskimo world, they had no measuring sticks, right, for deciding how they're going to build their kayak, right? There might be in all kinds of angles and curves and, thicknesses and, all that sort of thing, but it was all in here. Now, all they needed was a writing system, right? If they wanted to write about it. And it was that way with their whole world, right? Their whole cosmic world, their whole geography, and they had their whole, the entire environment, right? Could have been reduced to words if that was important, if they had the means to do it. But the knowledge that allowed these people to survive was extensive. Of course, it wasn't written down. It was written. And so, in effect, that's part of what we have in mind in the in what I hope will ultimately be a revolution in the way we educate our children. Even in my own area, right now, it's a it's a transplanted system that's brought in from God knows where with a very minimum of tinkering to benefit our children. It needs to be upended.
all the decades and decades of transplantation, is there a point of spiritual no return?
Oh, yeah. I won't name regions.
Well, I don't know. Yes, there is that place. And we see it all around us.
And from an individual standpoint, now I'm sure that
the spirit lives on everywhere in Alaska. But it's been severely damaged, you know, by the workings of the Western world, right? The guilt, you know, the religious, sort of a religious oppression, the mandate of government.
Well, let me read you something here.
just as a start. Where's all my stuff? I thought I had it here, but maybe I don't. No, I guess I left it over in the room. But no, I don't have it here. I could bring it the next time. But the official line on
what is to be placed in our children's head, of course, has been quite severe. The complete inability of the what you might call the colonizers to see the world through from the other point of view, right, made it difficult for them. And especially if you feel superior, right, if you feel like you were ordained by God to bring the word and civilization to those savages, then that. That is the kind of sort of a environment in which most of our people have tried to function, and consequently, that has resulted in a disintegration of the spirit and of the language and of the identity. And so, some of our people are perfectly content to live in San Francisco to become American. Which
isn't all that bad, I suspect. Yes. What do you feel about that? At least the support decision on the bilingual program.
Oh. On that score, he wants to know how I feel about Reagan's bilingual decision. I didn't. Frankly, I don't follow politics that much anymore. But, you see, the way I see it is that if a people wants to survive, who the hell's Reagan? Right?
What was Reagan?
He wants to eliminate federal support for bilingual education. Maybe we'll be better off. But you see, the way I see it is that if that group doesn't want to survive, should they even survive? I mean, if there is no will to survive among that group to maintain that continuity of spirit, and identity, language, doesn't deserve to survive. I guess that's that group's decision to make. And to me, it should not have anything to do with the outside world. Right? I mean, you should have, it has nothing to do with your wealthy or poor, you know, educated or uneducated. You know, if that group has a will to survive, it will survive. Even if they have to supplement their normal educational process with something of their own. And that is, in effect, what I'm advocating in our area. In fact, I didn't want the school involved. I was going to say, well, let's not fight it, right? No, we don't have any answers to that. If you're going to change it, you're going to have to upend the thing. You're going to have to practice change state law. If we even agree that, say, 50% of the time that our kids spend in the school is going to be spent, you know, half, you know, in the transfer of his identity and language and all that, and half the Western way. And that, to me, is fair. It sounds fair. And, but,
I was thinking, well,
if we even, you know, maybe we should kind of cause a great controversy. Let's just go do our own thing over here. You know, but, in reality, though, if we are truly red-blooded, God-fearing Americans, we should use the educational system as it has been used in America for a long time. That is, the system is designed to transfer local value because of your local control. That's part of the American dream, right? To convey your local values. Well, we shall begin to see if that is indeed permitted in this country. Because right now it's not working. We're not getting anything out of it. The children are coming out, well, we'll see by the end of the semester whether the band is still here. Well, I'm getting a few statistics from our school district just to see how many high school graduates are in college. Presumably that's a measure of success, right? And if the child has been instilled with this desire to carry on this process of education, and if they're falling by the wayside, then there's a problem, right? Because presumably he will be less able to fit into our economic system with a talent that is needed, an analytical talent that is needed by the system. I would be so bold as to say that it's not working adequately in most areas of the state right now because of the somewhat irrelevant aspect of the education to that student. Doesn't see what good it is for. And there's no real drive because it appears somewhat meaningless. Him since he could always enjoy staying home and hunting and working on snow machines for somebody or hauling cargo at the airport or, you know, maybe going off to the slope for a few weeks at a time sometimes. What I'm basically saying in this discussion is that for these groups, they're leaving their survival to chance. Too important. You have to plan it. It's like your own life, right?
And
that's right. Plan, right? Well, I haven't planned a damn thing in my life. I'm a poor example of that. But anyway, as I found out, you know, you unless you have in your mind some goal, some even if it's a vague one, you're not going to get there. And consequently, these groups have to look into the future and try to decide what the best thing is for their people. What kind of life are they going to try to, what kind of people are they going to try to build to live in what kind of life down the road? And we all know that, unfortunately, the world doesn't stand still. We can sort of stand it still somewhat because we have not developed any mechanisms for coping. It's kind of enjoyable. Like I spent that week with my sister about 30 miles from Kotzebue. It's kind of nice, you know. You get up when the sun comes up and damn near go to sleep when it goes down, you know. I mean, and there's no particular pressures on you except, you know, having to get your wood and get your water and get your animals. It's not that easy because it takes money to survive. You've got to buy things.
But at least you don't have to cope with a lot of unknowns. And you don't have to do what somebody else tells you to do, you know, like you do in an office. I mean, you still have to follow somebody's rules about hunting, but...
But we know that we can't survive that way, can we? Anymore. Except on a very minimal level. But... So we have to plan for the future. And we have to try to make the best of a... not a real fantastic situation. But see, the potential is terrific, though, because we've got the tools, right? We've got those gardening projects going. You know, it's just an adaptation. Have you ever heard of Eskimos farming? That sounds crazy, but the reality is that the best thing to do is to try to become as self-sufficient as possible, which we had been in the past, but because of the systems, you know, because of the destruction of virtually the almost extinction of the whale, the almost destruction of the walrus, you know, the virtual extinction of the sea otter, the almost extinction at one point of the bird seal. I mean, we have to be able to adapt, you see. And we have to plan for the future. Not just from a business or corporate standpoint, but from the standpoint of our people survival. So, just like the energy thing now, we have...
How do people afford that fuel?
You know, we're now so dependent. We built all these government homes with these oil heaters. So we're having to plug in some wood-burning stuff. We're looking around for coal and checking around for some... underground heat, you know, so that you can tap the steam or the heat down there, and you know, looking at different ways. And, you know, we're trying to do something that the state, in my opinion, has to do as well. You know, we have to look to the time when whatever we have is going to be scarce. And that, unfortunately, has not been one of the attributes of what civilization I've seen working in Alaska. And that you know, requires substantial restraint, doesn't it? Because when you're looking at things from a corporate standpoint, the idea is, of course, trying to maximize your profit. The more you can get, the more you can get in retained earnings, the more you can invest in some other venture, right? And consequently, they're pumping the oil out of Pluto Bay as fast as possible, right? It's the maximum capacity of the pipeline, 1.5 million barrels a day. And what's the state doing about it? Nothing. Do we have that much control?
Can we force the companies to screw it down a little so that we might get, say, 10 more years out of the oil field, and we wouldn't have this huge temptation to start moving the capital and doing all these wild things, right? Because after all, it's only a hope that there's more oil, isn't it? Nobody knows. It's just a hope. And, but what are the odds? Right, we're talking about.
Can you imagine? Right out here.
Forgetting about the fish. Right, this is the area. It's right there. That's the size of Texas. Right? And they got how many wells have they drilled out there? 30,000 or 50,000? They're still producing down there. And you know, they're talking about many Texas-sized regions here that they're planning to tap, but look at where it's at, though, you know?
And of course, if the country really wants it, then of course you've already seen one of Reagan's first acts is what they do.
Besides increasing our debt ceiling, decontrol the price of all.
So, anyway, today I promised myself I wouldn't go past 5:30
because it's tough on you. Right?
I didn't even get to what I was going to talk about today, but I'll tell you what I wanted to do with this. I wanted to give you some idea of the type of thing we might have in our test, right? These are some of the concepts and some of the incidences and some of the ideas that I want you to kind of think about as you're kind of reading your stuff. So I hope you took a look at it and let's see. This is the okay, good. Excellent. All right. God, we're organized around here. Yes? Probably so. I mean, this is not the test. These are just some things, right?
Throughout Southeast Asia. To abet China's power in the region and accelerate its growth are reasonable policies only if it can be assumed that our common interests far exceed our differences. Yet it remains a fact that the only common interest at present relates to the containment of the Soviet Union. On such critical issues as Korea, Taiwan, the future of Southeast Asia, not to mention various questions of a broader nature, no common ground has been established, as yet at least, despite various efforts. These are the basic arguments, and I cannot emphasize too much that the question of strategy preoccupies Washington today in its attempts to develop a new Asian policy. As you might expect, as our relationship with the Soviet Union deteriorates, the strength of the United Front theorists becomes stronger. And there is no question that at present, those who advocate a United Front strategy for Asia are in the ascendancy. My own proclivities being for the equilibrium strategy, I view this with some alarm. But I think that the social scientist has to separate his own views from his perceptions of what is happening. Now, it's against this background that I would like to take up separately and very briefly our relations with Japan and China, sketching the bilateral trends. Let me turn first to American-Japanese relations. Here, I think one of the difficulties is relating the rhetoric of the past to the strains of the present. It has long been commonplace for both American and Japanese leaders to assert that the alliance between the United States and Japan is the cornerstone of our general economic and political policies, not merely in Asia, but on a global front. Yet I suppose no one would deny today that despite the stake which both Americans and Japanese have in maintaining close economic, political, and cultural relations, the recent atmosphere has been clouded by controversy and occasional acrimony. The issues, as are well known, revolve primarily around economic matters. Trade, being massive in scale, has a dramatic effect upon the economies of both societies. In 1977, as you probably know, total U.S.-Japanese trade amounted to $29.1 billion. With a balance of payments surplus for Japan of over $8 billion. Since the overall trade deficit of the United States in that year was $26.7 billion, by far the worst deficit in American history, the downward plunge of the dollar on the international exchange market and the rapid appreciation of the yen were not surprising. Coupled with these developments have been the recurrent charges from American producers of unfair Japanese business practices, including dumping and industrial espionage. The pressure upon Congress to introduce protective measures has come from sectors of both business and labor, with the AFL-CIO adopting as its motto, not free trade, but fair trade. From the American side also, it has been argued that the Japanese government, and particularly the such powerful agencies as METI, the Ministry of International Trade and Industry, catering to their own economic interest groups and to traditionally sanctioned Japanese practices, have stonewalled in tackling certain thorny problems, notably the non-tariff barriers, making both the introduction and distribution of American products difficult. The situation has not been aided by the fact that certain American-Japanese multinational ventures have floundered, raising questions about the expansion of this type of cooperation. On the Japanese side, criticisms of American economic performance have been coupled with dismay at the absence of a domestic energy program or the type of monetary and fiscal policies that would serve the international economy well. Japanese spokesmen have asserted that the much vaunted American entrepreneurship of the past no longer seems prepared to accept the challenges of competition for overseas markets, having grown accustomed to a rich domestic fare. The issue of labor productivity in the United States has also been raised, and the absence of any program making for a transition from obsolescent industries. Can we be blamed, argue certain Japanese, for a more modern and aggressive free enterprise system? The most vigorous Japanese complaints, however, have been leveled at the seeming inability of the United States to bring oil imports, which totaled over $42 billion in 1977, under control, and the seeming inability also to move in the direction of helping to shape a new international monetary policy that would aid in stabilizing relations among the advanced industrial nations. In sum, the Japanese, as is true of many other people abroad, see grave defects in current American leadership. As is most complex issues, in my opinion, there is merit in the position of both sides. I will not go into the details here, but I think in summary it can be said that Japan finds it difficult to integrate its own economic institutions and practices with those of other advanced industrial societies in such a way as to become a working partner in a genuinely international economic system. A system which has worked so well for Japan internally is not easy to integrate with the international structure. The United States, on the other hand, I think cannot help but be faulted for the inadequate leadership that has produced virtually no progress with respect to a domestic energy program, no progress with respect to an international monetary system, and hence the inevitable problems of inflation and a vast set of deficits. Now, what can be done? We have to assume, first of all, that both governments will tackle their internal problems, that the Japanese can expand their growth rate and meet the 7% Fukuda target or come close to it. That at the same time, the Japanese can tackle something which for the LDP at least is equally formidable, the economic lobbies of the agricultural groups in Japan, who for very limited reasons, in my opinion, are making difficult the reduction of the trade deficit. But agriculture alone will not suffice. The Japanese have to move out and accept a much more open economic system. We, on the other hand, have got to tackle the problem of an energy program that makes sense, have got to bring our deficits under control, and have got to find ways to create a set of post-Bretton Woods monetary and economic policies. I shall not go deeply into the political and security aspects of American-Japanese relations, but here, too, certain strains are apparent. I think it might be said that all alliances today are less exclusive and all-encompassing, much more porous, providing for greater flexibility and independence for the parties involved than was characteristic of the period immediately after World War II. In part, this is because the old divisions of the world into coherent communist and anti-communist blocks, with a neutralist group as a weak third force, have given way to a much more diverse and complex set of global relations. So I think we can assume that while current the current American-Japanese alliance will continue in its broad forms. Japan will increasingly seek to pursue an independent foreign policy on some issues. The Middle East is, I think, a primary example. Moreover, the Japanese, and this is important, will resist a policy of united front strategy if it is attempted in any rigid fashion. Japan, despite its current problems with the Soviet Union, and they are serious, wants to preserve a flexibility in its relationship with the two communist major powers. Ideally, it wants to participate on the one hand in the massive task of developing Siberia, Russia's great frontier region, and on the other hand, play a leading role in abetting the Chinese Industrial Revolution, an equally massive task that lies ahead. Now, I think it is clear that at the moment Japan is tilting toward China, but it does not wish to regard this as a permanent position, and its wariness in accepting the Chinese-Japanese Treaty of Friendship is an example of the degree to which Japan attaches importance to flexibility in its relations with China and Russia. Let me turn in the remaining time to the question of our relations with China. On balance, here too, there are a series of issues which we must take very seriously in the period immediately ahead. The Chinese trade relationship with the United States is not very important. And I think the economic dimension of the U.S.-China relationship will remain relatively minor, irrespective of political developments. We could improve trade if the issue of frozen assets were resolved and most favored nation treatment were extended, both of which can be accomplished apart from the establishment of foreign diplomatic ties. But the fundamental obstacles to large-scale economic intercourse with China would remain, namely the limited Chinese export capacity, Chinese conservatism with regard to investments and foreign debts, and the more logical trade patterns elsewhere, notably with Japan. U.S. trade with the People's Republic of China totaled only $372.5 million in 1977. Compare that, $372.5 million, with $29 billion trade with Japan. Even if the China trade were to be significantly increased in the course of the next few years, as some have predicted, it will represent only a negligible percentage of total trade for the United States, and scarcely more, in my opinion, for China. As the past has indicated, China will purchase two types of commodities from the U.S., namely food products and high technology items. In the case of grain, alternative markets have generally existed, some with lower total costs for the Chinese. Certain high technology products, such as offshore oil rigging equipment, commercial aircraft, fertilizer plants, and advanced computers, can be obtained only from the United States or are regarded as of superior quality if American made. These have and will continue to be the prime desiderata for the PRC. For the most part, however, China's industrial needs can be acquired elsewhere more cheaply. A few U.S. companies and agricultural producers may benefit from the China trade, but the alluring prospect of 900 million customers should not be taken seriously for this era. I would not choose to predict 20 or 30 years hence. There is another respect, however, in which China expects to draw heavily upon the United States in the period immediately ahead. Among the sources from which science and technology are borrowed, the United States ranks high in Chinese consciousness. Already, American scientific journals are avidly followed, with many being translated. A ready audience exists for lectures by visiting American scientists. And arrangements are being made in particular for such scientists of Chinese background to assist in PRC advanced institutes and technological plants. A stream of Chinese delegations with specific scientific and technical interests come to the United States armed with questions. The issue of how fast and how far an emerging nation can go on the basis of the external borrowing of technology remains a hotly debated, exceedingly complex issue. But it is clear that with a new determination to make China, quote, a strong and prosperous nation by the end of the 20th century, unquote, a phrase from Zhou Enlai, the PRC leaders are determined to acquire as much as possible in the shortest period of time from the world's most advanced nations. Perforce, this is a one-way exchange for the most part. Except for such fields as acupuncture and herbal medicine, the possibilities of reciprocity are limited. Is such reciprocity feasible in the political and strategic reaches? Well, we have come back again to the issue of the United Front. Wherein lie the common interests between Washington and Peking? As I said earlier, they are, for the present, almost entirely confined to the mutual perception of a Soviet threat. But this naturally has broader ramifications. Thus, the People's Republic of China has emerged, curiously enough, as a champion of NATO and an augmented American presence in Europe. In Asia, also, the Chinese desire a selective American presence. They voice no objections to the American-Japanese security arrangement, nor to the continuance of a base agreement with the Philippines. The Seventh Fleet is no longer regarded as anathema. In Africa as well, Peking lauds all efforts to contain the Soviet Union and its surrogates and pledges limited assistance. I think it is important at this point to note very briefly the most salient features of Chinese foreign policy, so these can be related to the prospects of American-Chinese relations. At root, Chinese foreign policy today reflects the triumph of nationalism over the classic internationalist doctrines of Marxism. The vision of international solidarity of the proletarian has given way to the practice by an aspiring major power of traditional balance of power politics. To be sure, this does not mean the complete abandonment of an interest in or commitment to revolutionary movements. Yet such commitments must be coordinated with China's broader national interests. Thus, with the emergence of the Sino-Soviet cleavage, a basic change took place in the PRC conceptualization of the globe. The old image of a division of the world into two camps, socialist and capitalist, was dropped. China proclaimed that the socialist camp had been destroyed by the very source from which its leadership had emanated, the Soviet Union. Russia was no longer a socialist state, said Mao, but a fascist state. The New World Order had three fundamental parts: the superpowers, comprising the U.S. and the USSR, the second intermediate zone, made up of the advanced capitalist states, other than the United States, notably West Europe and Japan, and the third world, to which China proclaimed its own adherence. This remains the Chinese projection of the contemporary world at present. Attacks upon both superpowers continue, with accusations from Peking that each seeks to establish its hegemony over others. But the Soviet Union is defined as the principal enemy, however, and the United States is depicted as a declining power, hence less dangerous. Out of this analysis comes Peking's own United Front strategy. As early as 1972, Peking began to advance the case for the broadest possible front against Soviet social imperialism. In this, it borrowed extensively from the policies which the Chinese communists had pursued in the course of the Sino-Japanese War in the late 1930s. Just as Mao, following the Seventh Comintern meetings in Moscow in 1935, had called for a joint anti-Japanese effort with the Kuomintang, so Mao now began to advocate a limited détente with the United States against the Soviet threat. To the anti-Japanese front were to be added the Chinese national bourgeoisie, you can currently translate these as West Europe and Japan, and the proletarian peasant masses of China, which are now represented by the Third World. It must be understood that the United Front theory, as far as China is concerned, is conceived as a temporary measure to deal with immediate problems. It is tactical, not strategic, in the broadest sense. And on many issues, the PRC does not hesitate to denounce American policies. In Asia, for example, the Chinese position on Korea is strongly opposed to that of the United States. Peking has demanded the withdrawal of all American forces from South Korea and the acceptance of Kim Il-sung's reunification proposals. It is also clear that Chinese attitudes toward the Taiwan issue are in variance with ours, as well as most Chinese positions in Indochina, now enormously complicated by the fact that Vietnam, as many of us predicted, is seeking a certain degree of hegemony over Indochina, and this is being resisted by Peking, that wants no empire to its south. Well, it seems to me that in light of these facts, the common interests between the PRC and the U.S. are confined at the moment largely to the Russian issue. There are some fallouts from this, including, as I have noted, the support for our position in Europe and in certain parts of Asia. I want, in general, therefore, to assert that while I think the security, economic, and political ties with Japan will continue to be of vital significance, I do not see the emergence of a new triangle in Asia as of lasting value for American policy. This new triangle, presumably, would be to affront the Russians and stop their expansionism in the Far East. But as I suggested earlier, I think that Soviet expansionism in Asia is limited in its capacities by the foreignness of the culture, the inadequacy of the model, and in general, the lack of diplomatic skill. Our tasks, therefore, as I see it, are to solve our economic and political strategic problems with Japan, to make this at once a more flexible alliance, but also a more meaningful one. And this will require a cooperation by the governments and the peoples of both societies, first with respect to their domestic problems. The interrelationship between domestic problems and foreign policy has never been more intimate, and subsequently on both a bilateral and a multilateral basis, to continue the dialogue with both China and the Soviet Union, keeping in mind the fact that the Russians are a global power, the Chinese at most a regional power, still enormously weak in economic and strategic terms. We want to keep the door open for dialogue, in my opinion, on all conceivable issues, and certainly encourage the development of trade and economic intercourse to the extent that these are feasible, but not at the expense, I would assert, of abandoning any allies or giving up any basic principles. Our economic relations with Taiwan, as you know, far exceed those with the PRC and are likely to continue to do so. More importantly, it seems to me, the strategic and political credibility of the United States hinges upon our not abandoning Taiwan. Thus, recognition of the PRC has to be worked out in a fashion requiring reciprocal compromises by Peking and Washington. Let me close by saying that in the final analysis, trends in American-Russian relations will govern the course of global events in the decade immediately ahead more than any other single factor, and this includes the nature of alignments in Asia. Thus, if U.S. relations with the Soviet Union continue to deteriorate, the case for an American-Japanese-Chinese entente, notwithstanding what I've just said, will have been greatly strengthened, even though I think it is clear that such a relationship will be largely tactical in nature potentially destabilizing in Asia in the long run and productive of a further downward slide in American-Soviet relations. The current trend is in that direction, with the caveat that abrupt changes are always possible in the volatile political atmosphere in which we live. Thank you.
Speaker, Mr. Bob Palmer, representing the Office of the Governor, and he was going to speak on potential markets for Alaska aqua and agriculture. Unfortunately, Mr. Palmer can't be here today. However, we have a most outstanding replacement, who, however, cannot speak on the subject of aquaculture, although he is very well qualified indeed to speak on the subject of agriculture. We are privileged to have today Dr. Wayne Thomas, Associate Professor of Economics, University of Alaska, assigned to the Agricultural Experiment Station and holding a position in the School of Management. Dr. Thomas received his PhD in Agricultural Economics from Washington State University. His special area of interest and expertise is in agricultural marketing and the development of agriculture markets. Dr. Thomas has recently toured the East Asia as a member of the Governor's Agricultural Trade Mission to the Orient. He is responsible for the feasibility work on the Delta Barley Project, and he has published relative to that project as well as in the areas of land and recreation economics. We are indeed privileged to have with us this morning Dr. Wayne Thomas.
Good morning. I have a statement here which would suggest that if I talk much about aquaculture, I would show my ignorance a great deal. So I decided that I best not do that. And when I got the phone call to make the, when I got the request to give this speech, I wasn't even aware that aquaculture was a part of the title of the talk. So I blissfully said yes, and then I found out that I had said yes to something I knew nothing about. So I knew something about agriculture, and so I guess the reason I was asked to give the speech was because I know of that subject. And I'll ask it. All right. Issue of agricultural development in Alaska is one that is, at least in the last few weeks here in Fairbanks, somewhat front page news, largely because of something called the Delta Barley, and I put that in quotes, unquote, project, which is in the Delta Clearwater area, 100 miles to the south and east of here. The state legislature has just approved a bill which commences that project. It takes into account about 60,000 acres in the first section. The clearing program has commenced with a test clearing project over the last year for, of about 2,000 acres. The other 58,000 will be cleared starting in about 2.5 months. The 2.5 months, the leeway is the contract, the clearing contracts are being drawn up, or at least the proposed clearing contracts. There'll be a bid process. And one of the reasons that Bob Palmer's not here is because he's worrying on that problem, as I understand it. To give you just a little bit more insight about that, and I'll go briefly through this project, because it, the basis of the additional work is the, this project that I'm going to discuss today. There is 22 farms. They will be broken in between 2,000 and 3,500 acres approximately each. A lottery will occur on the 5th of August of this year, a selection process using that lottery will come to pass, and 22 farmers will be out there. The land will not be ready to farm, but they will have the land on the 5th in Delta. There is approximately in the pool at the moment about 60 qualified partnerships or individual proprietorships. Just for your information. The crops as we envision them are three: barley, rapeseed, which is an oilseed crop, similar to soybeans. The third one is buckwheat, which is used for noodles and other things. Those are the at least the exportable crops that we can foresee at the moment. Lastly, the most interesting aspect of this, the one that I will probably delve in the least though, is the risk aspects, because a new venture like this, on a large-scale basis, does have certain inherent risks. It would have to be called a venture, it would require venture capital if the private sector were funding it entirely, with a discount rate required to be quite high. Several of the risks are, we have no lengthy recorded history of production of rapeseed, for example, in the state of Alaska. Barley we have, maybe the last 10 years in the Delta area, longer than that, much longer than the Matanuska Valley. It's interrupted. There was agriculture in the interior of Alaska before, back in the around the gold rush times and through the 30s, but it pretty much stopped with a few exceptions, started up again with this project, basically. Okay. I'll go beyond the project now, and I'm going to discuss three areas this morning. One, the current market situation for barley and rapeseed in the Orient, and I will go fairly briefly over that one. Investment possibilities in this and other projects, agricultural type projects in Alaska. I'll probably primarily emphasize this project because of time. And finally, I'll try to draw some implications. I'm interested in the development issues, and I'll draw some implications of those, the importance of government in this project, and thirdly, some advantages and disadvantages of foreign investment as it relates to this project and other projects, agricultural types, in the state of Alaska. Current market situation. We'll start with Japan because it is the prime market for agricultural commodities that might be produced in Alaska. Prime for several reasons. One, it has 100 million people. It's a developed economy, a strong economy. They import barley, for example, something around 2 million metric tons of barley are imported each year. The Canadians and the Australians are their prime suppliers. An interesting aspect of the Japanese situation is that the government controls the purchase of barley. The Food Agency, Import Division, Food Agency, Ministry of Agriculture and Fisheries, Government of Japan. Without permission of that group, you do not sell barley into Japan. The trading firms, the major trading firms in Japan, have basically been given segments of the barley market. In other words, Mitsubishi may in fact purchase 22% of the barley that's consumed or purchased and goes into Japan. That percentage pretty much holds, and Mitsui will have a certain percentage, and several of the others, Sumitomo and on. So there's a very close working relationship between the Japanese government and the private sector trading firms. Right at this moment, the import division is considering creating a special category for the importation of Alaskan barley. And within the next 2 weeks, they're going to give a response. The expectation from this side, it will be a positive response, so that Alaskan barley can be sold into the Japanese market. The interesting thing about rapeseed, which is a high-value oilseed crop, is that it is not controlled by the government of Japan from the point of view of purchase and shipment into the country. The major reason, the only reason, is that it is not directly consumed by the populace. The government controls purchases if, in fact, it's directly consumed. Rapeseed is crushed, the seed is crushed, the oil is used for cooking oil, the meal is used for livestock feed. So the direct consumption does not occur. The way you handle rapeseed sales into Japan are this. You find a rapeseed buyer, and the corporation you are working with, if you're competitive on a world market, and that world market price is basically a Canadian price because it's the largest exporter of rapeseed, if you're competitive with that price, you would be a second supplier of seed this type to Japan. They're very interested in having at least two suppliers of any commodity from two different countries. Once you find the buyer, and generally would be associated with the Rapeseed Processors Association in Japan, they would then contract with a trading firm, a Japanese trading firm, who would in fact be the buyer of the product from say, Alaska, or from Canadian sources. I'm going to move on to South Korea now, the Republic of Korea. The second country that is a major importer of barley in the region of East Asia is Korea. It's an interesting market in one sense because it is a major barley producer itself, whereas the Japanese do not produce much barley. They produce around 200 million tons, as I remember the figure, out of the 2 million they import. Well, the Koreans can in some years produce all of the barley they consume, and in other years they produce very little because of varying weather conditions. It's on a year-by-year basis. For an example, last year they imported something around half of their consumption. 2 years ago they imported no barley. So by its definition, this simple fact would not necessarily make it a prime market, whether you're talking about agricultural products or any other kind of products. If in fact a buyer comes in and out of the market, then you would have to use that as more of a surplus market for your sales. The barley, again, is imported, controlled by the government of South Korea. It is purchased through a government supply arm. And they do not, interestingly enough, use barley for feed in livestock production in Korea. One of the few countries in the world that imports a great quantity of barley, or can import a great quantity of barley, and not use it for feed. There appears to be a local preference, a population preference, for yellow-colored feeds for their livestock. Interestingly enough, the color is very important. The barley is used for human consumption. Causes a particular problem for an exporter from this area, and I haven't gotten into this to any great extent, and I won't, but we tend to produce a high-protein barley for reasons, primary reasons, the long days out there. And the barley plant responds to length of day in a manner that is different from barley produced in many other areas. This high-protein barley has quite great advantages in livestock feeder as it would in human food. Well, one of the proposals that we were informed of when this trade mission went to Japan or into Korea last fall was that the Korean army consumes a great deal of barley and they would like to increase the protein content of their ration. I guess that's a good word you can use. And they would look very favorably on high-protein barley in that regard. So if I were a seller of barley, which I'm not, but if I were a seller of barley, I would, if you can try to differentiate your market in this sense, make a case for a quality in a product that other products of similar type might not have, gives you certain advantages in that marketplace. The third country that is of importance in East Asia is Taiwan, Republic of China. The Taiwanese are major importers of feed grains. From a U.S. standpoint, they bring in corn to a great extent. They bring in Australian barley. They are in a unique position in one sense because they are concerned, I guess, from what we've learned earlier, of continuing a good relationship with the United States. The Taiwanese, as a good example, have made an offer to buy every ton of barley that's produced in Alaska, starting right now, long-term contract. There are several reasons for that. One of them is that they are a major consumer of barley. Two, it is also a crop that comes out of a part of the United States. And this might, in fact, be looked at favorably. I assume that's their reasoning. There may be others that I'm not aware of. They were impressed, it appears, from the point of view of the quality of the product which appears to be produced here. So the political ramifications of a situation will, in fact, whether a commodity can be sold on an export basis. And I suspect if the relationships between two countries were to deteriorate, that would affect the purchase of commodities on an export basis. We have certain advantages here, as well as the Canadians, the rest of the United States, and Australia. We three countries, U.S., Australia, and Canada, are basically the major exporters of grain products. The Soviets, the Chinese, Japanese especially, if they're going to feed livestock, they have to import. The Soviets are not quite that. They can, in fact, they can produce pretty much what they consume, and in bad years they have to import. But most everybody else needs to import if they're going to increase their meat consumption. All right. I'll relate this back to the project a little bit now. Given time problems, I'll go through this somewhat rapidly. As I said before, Japan is classified the prime market, because it's large, it has a growing economy, it's an industrialized society with a gross national product on a per capita basis comparable to the United States. It imports most of the food it consumes now. Especially, it has a problem with the 200-mile limit. I'll get into fisheries a little bit. The 200-mile limit, as declared by the United States and the Soviet Union particularly, has reduced the capability of the Japanese to fish on the high seas. Its major protein source is, in fact, fish from fresh products. When you restrict its fishing capability, it must, if it's a well-developed economy with a wealthy economy, and one that wants to, its population wishes to continue to consume protein, must find other sources. And its sources it's moving toward are poultry, pig meat consumption, and beef consumption. Because of certain developmental strategies that the country has, it tends to want to buy the feed and produce its own livestock inside its own borders. At this moment, that can work to ours, the Canadians, the rest of the United States, and the Australian advantage. As far as the Taiwan situation, I said it as I related earlier. It appears we are probably in a favorable situation because of we can be competitive, we think, with barley they buy in other areas, but more importantly, the Taiwanese are very interested in keeping good relationships with the United States. As far as Korea is concerned, they're less dependent upon products of which we can produce here, and much more interested in talking about fisheries when it comes to Alaska, I must say. So it would have to be rate that as the third market in East Asia. The most important aspect of Alaska, in my opinion, on a marketing strategy basis in relation to these three countries, is that we need to make it quite clear that we can differentiate our product in the sense that, in other words, I think there's some economic advantage to that. What I mean by differentiating our product, if in fact our high protein barley, higher protein than what they can buy in some other areas, does exist, and it appears it does, there is certain advantages to use that barley in a livestock ration. In other words, you don't have to have as much high-priced protein supplement. In the case of the Koreans, you might be able to get more protein to your army by just buying a higher protein barley. So in a market strategy case, if you differentiate your product, you may have some advantages. If nothing else, if you're competitively priced, it may have longer, it can give you some advantage in just staying in that market a little longer, possibly. Have some advantage over other comparably priced product. Okay. In grain terminology in sales, if you can have an identity to your grain, there's generally some advantage. In the U.S., it's very difficult, say in Portland, which is a major terminal for exporting U.S. grain. When Montana barley shows up and Washington barley comes in and North Dakota barley comes in, and it's mixed in bins because on a large scale basis, it's very, very difficult. In fact, it's almost impossible to separate one regional barley from another. And there are certain regional advantages in those areas, too. One of the nice things about the situation here is the fact that we are not going to be a part of, in one sense, that marketing system. And that one sense is our grain is going to always remain separate therefrom. In other words, it'll be shipped directly out of Alaska and not go down to Seattle or Portland and then shipped out. Investment possibilities, third aspect of the talk today. Investment possibilities for this project. I can see three different investment possibilities, and I'm going to discuss it by groups that could make these investments, and what they are, and exactly what kind of implications are associated with that. First is state investment, government investment by state government. In the particular Delta project, there is an $8 million clearing investment that's going to be going into this large project, approximately $8 million. The clearing, there are several reasons why the state has decided to do it, separately from allowing the individual farmers to do it at their own request and desires. That is because they feel from the 2,000 acre clearing project that they can substantially reduce the cost of clearing per unit, which in this case is per acre, as if individuals were contracted separately or do it their own self, for that matter. There are some significant economies of scale in clearing. As an example, down in the Delta Clearwater area, farmers have cleared land for up to $250 and $300 an acre if you wanted to include all implicit costs associated with their operations. The project, it appears the clearing cost will be something less than $100 an acre to a quality of ground comparable to most any other farming area, just because we're talking about a large-scale clearing venture. The repayment of that clearing cost will be with the individual farmers on a low-interest, long-term basis. Low interest, something around 6, possibly up to, no, it's set at 6%. The length of repayment is 40 years. Done very specifically to add incentive to the project so people will have a better chance of making this thing. As far as the next category you can talk about is farm loans. You have several sources that you could obtain farm loans, but a major one will be the state government itself as a loaning entity. Through the loaning of base of monies from the Renewable Resources Fund, which is a subsector of the Permanent Fund. If you're familiar with the Permanent Fund. This appears to be the approach that that is going to be taken. Low interest money, the length of term will be as necessary, and it'll probably be, in other words, it will not be a tight, you must pay back every X months if something starts happening out there. Because of the ventureness of this thing, in the first years, that is. After projects underway and other ones come along, they'll tighten their ship up quite considerably here. That's my impression. Okay, infrastructure is another component of state investment. Infrastructure implies elevators, both interior and terminal, and a railroad extension, which is federal responsibility. There is, in fact, tentatively plans for a $35 million investment to extend the railroad to Delta from the Eielson Air Force Base. That is, it will depend on the tonnage coming off the project and other ensuing projects in the area, and there'll probably be others. The federal government will have to decide on that one. In fact, there's a meeting in Washington next week to further the discussions on that extension. Regarding the inland elevator, there's about $1,800,000 requirement between $1,400,000 and $1,800,000. The state has appropriated the money, has one of two options. Can build it itself and lease it out, can loan the money out, ask for repayment at low interest, long term, and have private sector manage it. Hasn't been decided. My guess it'll be the second. Finally, the port terminal elevator situation. Interestingly enough, the Alaska Railroad has several interesting possibilities on this one. They're working quite hard on this project because I guess they see it as a major commodity movement for them. The economic engineering planning for that port terminal situation is going on now. The costs could be substantial. It's hard to know. Volumes through it will be limited at the beginning and pick up substantially as the project moves on and other projects come online. Two risk factors you can see in the infrastructure. Well, the inland terminal elevator situation, inland country elevator, you have both an export and a domestic market potential use, which increases the feasibility of that area substantially. You get to the terminal situation, you tend to lose the domestic use. So volumes of the terminal elevator are based on export, making it more risky. You've got to keep those volumes up or you're going to have a white elephant on your hands. Private sector funding or investments, U.S. private sector, we'll say, because we'll differentiate it from that from the foreign private sector. For your information, offers have been made to purchase the entire project by one corporation, U.S. corporation. They would invest their own private capital. They would produce the crops and sell them, and it would be a completely non-public investment, and they take the risk as this investment as they would take the risk of any other type of investment. Okay, there's that would surely minimize state involvement, wouldn't it, if you did that? You remove something called the family farm concept. I love this concept because it comes up often. But in fact, these large farms are, because they're very heavily capital intensive, are in fact family operations. Can be run by man, wife, and a couple of children, if necessary. Kids gonna have to work a little hard, but then they can do that, yes. The government of the state government, from the current governor on down, have said that large an investment by one firm would be politically unacceptable, state-wise. So, by that definition, when you say those, when you make that institutional determination, you exclude much of the venture capital of the private sector. So you bring it back to the state government. In other words, not necessarily that the investment is all that bad. It's that if one group is going to make the investment, they'd like to have the whole picture instead of parts of it. That appears to be what the way that the private sector is viewing this project. All right. As far as the financial community within the private sector, for individual loans to the farmers, if a guarantee were a loan guaranteed by the state government, good old state government again, as soon as you take out that the possibility of major private sector involvement, something called a loan guarantee is requested. The private sector financial community will be involved if their loan guarantees exist. Risk. And as far as the U.S. financial sector is concerned, the risk is there. They're trying to minimize the risk either by guarantees or take all of the risk in planning to, if they take all the risk, figure they've got the full control of the project to take that risk with. So it's kind of an all or nothing thing. Foreign investment, third possibility. On the infrastructure, particularly on the infrastructure, there is, in my opinion, a distinct possibility that Japanese investment could be obtained for probably both of the elevator situations within the state. If in fact that were to come to pass, you would then reduce substantially the state involvement in long-term loans to those two systems. If you did that, probably be one trading firm that would do it, Mitsubishi, somebody, Sumitomo, Sito, some, could be any one of them, and there's a number more. The implication of that would be that they would be the buyer of the product that would be produced and shipped through. You could even take it as far as the land. They could, instead of, they might not buy the land, I don't know, I'm just speculating here a great deal. They could conceivably be a supplier of the on-farm capital, loanable funds necessary to operate the project, tending to tighten down their control of supply. Some advantages to that. They would probably be much happier if the venture would be underway for a certain period of time, so they can get an idea whether it's going to make it or not. The longer it exists, I think the better chances that foreign, especially Japanese involvement, could come to pass. All right, coming to the end of the talk, the one section on implications that I would like to discuss. The development project of this type in a region that doesn't have agriculture development to speak of, there's a number of pieces to the puzzle that are being put together, have been over the last 2 years in the planning process. The pieces include the farms, the transportation, the handling, the storage, the availability of tractors and inputs to the production process, the financing, roads, markets, and to put it very bluntly, it's a difficult process, I think. There's been a group of 20 people working on this project for 2.5 years now, and some of the parts of it have come together very nicely, and other parts have come together less nicely. It appears that the parts will come together by 1980, when in fact the first major crop should come off. And that's the other one if, is that 1980 is the expected date, but 1981 may be in fact the first crop season, depending on how quickly that clearing can take place. And there's a couple of ifs out there. So I'll give you an example of a couple of the problems that are surfacing. So do you plan investment in your large capital investments for elevators for online stream at 80 or 81? If they come online in 80, for an example, and they're sitting pretty idle for that period, somebody who's made that investment's not getting any return on it for a period of time. So there's certain disadvantages of not knowing. Okay, complexity. Another issue of this project is complexity. Because there are so many pieces, it is a complex situation. There has been some criticism of it, and probably with some degree of correctness, that suggests that if we produced more red meat, for an example, using some of our barley in red meat production, then we would have a higher value crop, or meat, in fact, commodity, to which we could either use locally, and there's a substantial market. 95% of our red meat comes in from outside the state, so it appears the economics are there to produce red meat in large enough volume to hit that market. Problem you got is the more pieces you put in the puzzle, the more difficult it is to pull it off. And in my personal opinion, and the others associated with the project, I think, is that the too many pieces and it'll fail. It'll just the chances of failure are enhanced dramatically. So the intent of the planners and the advisors, and I classify myself as an advisor, is that to keep it as simple as possible, and with some degree of possibility of success. And we think there's a pretty good one. Okay. Why was it, and this basically kind of explains to you why kind of a grain project was selected. A grain project was selected because it is the most non-complex agricultural type production available. And our large areas, high cost of labor, situation here in Alaska, limited labor capabilities in the sense of just they're very limited. High cost implies that you're going to have to pay dearly to get a lot of labor out there in your farm production. This would tend to, from an economic standpoint, make you go for capital-intensive type operations. The Australians have gone that way in their large development projects. The Canadians have also. We have the same kind of problems in many respects. Importance of government. Second aspect of the implications. In selling. Interestingly enough, in my personal opinion, the credibility of this project from an export marketing standpoint is based in large measure on the fact that state government is saying it is a state project. That has a two-edged sword associated with it, though. If, in fact, it becomes a state project, and these tentative agreements which say that grain will be sold in such and such a date, even those kind of statements, and those kind of statements, if that cannot be accomplished because of problems in the project, it tends to really destroy the credibility of the state in relation to this project. You get into the market because we think it's a state project anyway. To a great extent, you get in because it's a state project. But you can easily affect what will happen in the future for other projects if you cannot meet the commitments that you're tentatively making this time. That has relevance to not just the state-type projects, but a good example is the regional and village corporations in ANSCA. Alaska Native Land Claim Settlement Act. They are government-created entities, and I have a suspicion that if you were an Oriental buyer of some commodity that a village or a regional corporation was selling, you get the feeling that you were dealing with a government agency. And whether in my opinion, not necessarily relevant, but that is the case. In other words, belief is much more important than actual fact in this case. So if I were in the export market, especially with the Japanese, and I was from a village or regional corporation, I think I'd keep that in mind. That's my opinion as to their viewing of just because when you create something by government, the Oriental to a great extent, or the Japanese appears to be that begins to mesh something in the way they create some of their economic structures. So it makes sense to them. From the point of view of the farmers, there is certain advantages to having a government involvement in the project from a marketing standpoint. There's a report that's over on your desk, something about Alaska grain and oilseed export marketing. It in fact talks about the possibility of the creation of an export marketing board, which would facilitate sales of agricultural products from Alaska using the state government as the buyer and seller of said crops. Buyer from the farmer and seller to the buyer, the export buyer. And why would this what can this have any relevance? Well, interestingly enough, there's a test marketing program going on right now. State of Alaska is functioning as a marketing board. It is buying about 2,000 to 3,000 metric tons of barley and rapeseed this year from commercial producers within Alaska. It is then reselling those commodities to the Orient at world market price, both buy and sell. I mean, there's no implicit subsidy in price. But what it's done is that there are some local feed buyers have gone out for the first time in my knowledge of the area and have actually forward contracted with farmers in the state of Alaska, feed buyers from the state, because they were afraid that their market wasn't going to be there anymore. Their supply wasn't there. So, it's an interesting thing. By the creation of this market, by the simple act that the government is involved in buying, or some entity, it doesn't have to be the government, you see substantial changes in the picture of the way people buy and sell things in the marketplace. There are some disadvantages with and advantages with government involvement in markets, and again, they're just recounted in this thing, so I won't recount them here. If you're interested, you can read them. I'll end my talk with some couple of statements on foreign investment. I think a major advantage of foreign investment, it would be a capital source that could be supplied from outside the state. If, in fact, you're in a capital short region, that is a distinct advantage, I think. It also, by its action, establishes a long-term market channel for the commodity. If a foreign corporation is going to make an investment, the expectation is they're going to use that investment. They're going to buy the product, use their facilities, and so you've established this channel that has some advantages. It also tends to remove risk responsibility for those structures and even the project to a certain degree from U.S. investors. It has some advantages along those lines. They accept the risk instead of someone within the confines of this political entity. Some disadvantages. First one, from a farmer perspective, it reduces the option of sale. If, in fact, a firm controls the marketing structure, then in fact, it's very difficult for the individual farmers to sell it anyplace else. No, they can't do it, probably, in this country. It reduces the ease of that. It's largely because there isn't facilities to handle it, for example. This project that we're talking about in the Delta area isn't really large enough for more than one market structure. In other words, you're not going to have several elevators in the interior and several elevators in the terminal right now because there just isn't enough volume for it. There's enough volume for one of each. Second one, in the case of Alaska, at least given the proposed amount of capital available in the permanent fund, capital shortage for renewable resources projects do not seem to be a problem. At least that's what we're told. If that's the case, there is an attempt to reinvest certain amount of the permanent fund within the sector, the Alaska economy, the renewable resource sectors of the Alaska economy, then foreign investment can't be classified as necessarily an advantage. Finally, the control of the project, and whether that control is desired by state government or farmers or whoever controls it. So at this stage, it's difficult for me to know what that word control actually means from between groups, because the groups are kind of still sparring as to who gets control, I guess. The control of the project from in-state sources reduces, and the control of the project from outside sources commences, which is basically much of the economy of the state of Alaska is controlled by sources outside the state. Not necessarily good or bad, but that in fact would be the last disadvantage. Well, I wouldn't, at least it's viewed to be as a disadvantage by some, so I put it in the disadvantage category. Okay, that's basically what I had to say today, and I'm sure later we'll have a chance for questions. Thank you.
In order for our third speaker, Mr. Terry Brady of Forest North Limited, to speak to you this morning, an extremely fine intermesh of assorted airline carriers had to occur. Is Mr. Brady here this morning? An extremely fine intermesh of aircraft carriers did not occur. So with that, let's take a 5-minute break. We are privileged today to have as our discussant Dr. Leon Hallerman, currently professor of economics, Claremont Men's College and Claremont Graduate School, California. Dr. Hallerman received his PhD in economics from the University of California at Berkeley, having previously studied in the areas of mathematics, statistics, and economics from George Washington University, American University, and the University of Rochester. Dr. Hallerman has been a Fulbright Senior Research Scholar in economics, Japan, 1963, 64, 64, 65, and 71, 72. And in addition to the many academic awards he has received, he's a member of the American Council of Learned Society Fellows in American Studies in Japan, 1963, 64, and 71, 72. He has served as advisor to the Committee for Economic Development and consultant to the Stanford Research Institute. Further, he has served as international trade economist on the economic and scientific section of GHQ, Supreme Command for the Allied Forces in Tokyo, Japan. Dr. Hallerman has published widely as an economist specializing in international trade and economic development, and with special emphasis and knowledge of Japan, her foreign trade, and her role in economic development. Dr. Leon Hallerman.
I think this is a very propitious moment for discussing the Japanese solution to the problem of the symposium, namely the development of the rural Alaskan economy. It's propitious because of various favorable circumstances from an Alaskan point of view and various unfavorable circumstances from a Japanese point of view. I think that consideration of the problem at hand from a Japanese point of view would be perhaps productive, and I'd like to make some comments on that as my contribution to the discussion. In the first place, as Professor Scalapino has outlined in his superb discussion, there is an adversary relationship between the United States and Japan that's been accumulating for some time now, and it's very urgent that it be reversed. I think that Alaska and the problems of development of rural Alaska in particular may provide a means of access to that solution, actually, because fortunately Alaska is not a separate country, not an LDC on its own feet, but it's part of the United States as a whole. And the United States as a whole, the lower 48 problems are perhaps distinctly different from those of Alaska's problems. I think Alaska's problems afford a more convenient complementary